Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 28th, 2005. Today's session is Healing the World, Hope for Holy Ground. Jubilee, Property Rights, and Takings. Who Owns the Land? A Bible study presented by Barbara Rossing in the Fireside Room. Disc number ROB 2005-04. Let's listen in.
To this earlier hour Bible study. I'm Barbara Rossing, and this is the fourth in our little series this week on healing the land, hope for holy ground, looking at ecology in the Bible. As I've said, I'm a New Testament scholar. I teach New Testament and Greek, but today we're going to venture into the Old Testament. So hopefully that will level the playing field. You're all as much of an expert as I am. I didn't even bring the Hebrew Bible. I mean, I could have brought it, you know, in Hebrew, but and theoretically I can read it because I passed exams in Hebrew, but it was a long time ago. So let's just view all of ourselves as experts today. And hopefully that'll also allow more time for discussion, because I realize I've been going like right up to the end of the sessions and not having as much time for discussion. So today, bring all your questions from all the sessions so far. And comments or responses. I can't remember what I titled this session. I think it was something like Land Ethics, Property Rights, the Common Good, Jubilee, and How to Balance Those Kinds of Issues. Because today at Holden is Jubilee Day, when we look at least in some way at the Jubilee text of Leviticus 25 and other places in the Bible where there's this notion of correcting inequalities, of going back every 50 years or in some way every 50 days, that's why it's today the 50th day of summer, to restore inequality. Yeah, that Jubilee was invented at Holden as theoretically the 50th day of summer program, but I don't know if that's what it is this year, but it was a created holiday at Holden after we ceased to celebrate Christmas in July, which used to be the old July 25th holiday. So we've reinvented it, but it's, you know, all these are made up holidays, of course. But it's good to look at some of these texts texts and traditions in the Bible that are really rather amazing. I just want to say, though, I also want to go back to discussing as part of this and part of what I've been doing so far, some of the questions about empire, because I'm sure those are going to come up, and tomorrow especially when we look at Koinonia, and what can we do about this whole environmental issue, and as communities of the gospel, God's Koinonia, what does it mean for you, I'll ask later in the hour, if empire is indeed coming to an end, and if there are analogies between the Roman Empire, as I've proposed, and our time today, and the end of oil, and the end of our life in some sense as we know, what does that mean for us, and how can we be those communities that God is calling us to be? So I want to hear from you, and also get ideas from my book too. But why don't we start with some of these other Jubilee issues. It has been interesting to me, well, let's just say I have a sister who's an engineer, an environmental engineer. My sister Jane Rossing Frankenberger, actually, I was looking at some of her tapes in the Holden Library this morning, too. She teaches agricultural engineering at Purdue University and works a lot with farmers in Indiana, northern rural Indiana. And we've been talking about maybe trying to write something together about the whole issue of property rights and takings that is such a hot issue right now. In America and in the courts, certainly, about how much absolute rights over a piece of land does a property owner have to do whatever they want. And this is a dilemma in many, many ways in our country. Maybe you've experienced it also. I mean, certainly it's frustrating for anyone who's come up against it from either side. For Jane, I should say, and I even wrote this up as a little case study with my students last year in this Bible class, we're finding now that the Gulf of Mexico, a huge zone out in the Gulf of Mexico, is what they call the dead zone because of what's called hypoxia, that is too much oxygen. Or is it, no, not enough, sorry, too little. Hype is too little, yeah, because of too much nitrogen. Okay, and this is being caused by us in the Midwest, everything from the Mississippi River that feeds into that, so all the tributary rivers in Missouri, the Ohio, whatever, A variety of causes, but a lot of it is nitrates and fertilizer. I'm sure I'm going to massacre the science of this, but anyway, that come from what's called non-point source pollution. In other words, in the U.S. now we have relatively strong laws about point source pollution. I mean, you can't put a pipe into Railroad Creek and have your raw sewage going out there. That's against the law. And you can't do that out of a factory either. That's point source pollution, a pipe. But non-point source is the runoff that's more generalized. And you still, in America, can largely do that. You are allowed to go out every day in your lawn with your Scott's Turf Builder or whatever it is that you like to use. You can fertilize your lawn to death, even though it's striking to me now in eastern Washington to drive, say, through Wenatchee, just as an example, but any street in America, to see the sprinklers come on every day and the water is coming off the lawns, down the streets, into the storm sewers, into the Columbia River eventually. And so whatever a suburban homeowner has put on their lawn is running off. And this is legal, largely. But this is the dilemma. This is called non-point source pollution because it's certainly pollution, but it's not coming out of a specific pipe. You can't trace it back to that person's lawn as opposed to that person's lawn. Or in the rural economy, you can't trace the runoff of nitrates to that farmer rather than that farmer. But as a watershed together, we are killing the Gulf of Mexico. And what do you do about that? Because every year that dead zone is increasing. And is there something we should do about that? Or do property owners up in Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin have absolute rights to put whatever they want on their fields, and if it runs off, that's too bad for the people who fish in the Gulf of Mexico. So it's those kinds of issues, I think, that are facing us in so many ways in the United States right now. And what does it mean in terms of property ownership? What does that give you? And is there a way that the Bible says anything about that or not? And of course, let me just say, I mean, I know that we're now into the field of ethics, and it's a real question how you apply ethics from biblical times, which was such a different, you know, non-industrialized society. For heaven's sakes, I mean, the basic principles of capitalism were outlawed in the Bible, you know, like taking interest on loans. You couldn't have had the capitalist system without superseding the Bible. And even superseding Luther. He also, still in a pre-capitalist time, was big into this idea that you couldn't collect interest. Usury laws, you know, were very strong back then, and those had. So, you know, we've already moved beyond the Bible in a lot of ways. But are there ways that we can look to the Bible for some of what we want to have be our land ethic and for how to temper competing rights and claims? It's been striking to me. You know, I ordered this book in the mail, America's Providential History. I read to you a little bit out of it yesterday. This is a right-wing, extremely fundamentalist Christian homeschooling American history textbook. And it's alarming how many millions of copies of this have sold and are apparently in use. And this view of, so I looked at the chapter on biblical economics and I'm kind of interested in this one. And I want to read some to you from this, because what the authors of this claim is that a biblical economy means basically individual property rights trump everything else, and they find that in the Bible. But the interesting thing to me is they're not citing any biblical text for this. I want to argue because, in fact, you can't find very many biblical texts, although you can find a few. I've got some on the board here. Okay, so let me just read a little bit out of here. Because it's very interesting. Okay, here, this is on page 212. This is my favorite one because it has the Statue of Liberty over here. And then it says, the roadbed, a Christian constitutional form of government. A civil government based on biblical principles provides the road on which the wheel of economic progress can turn with great efficiency. Such a government, rooted in the law and the gospel and based on the Christian idea of man and government, will assist economic progress by providing an environment of freedom with order in which production and exchange can flourish, protecting private property, punishing theft and fraud, and not providing for the people's economic needs. And I think that last phrase is really interesting. Not. Because remember, this is the fundamentalist, in fact, dominionist, very, very right-wing Christian perspective, that providing for people's economic needs is not government's job. In fact, it's bad because that makes people lazy and non-productive and stuff. So, but yeah, just it's very interesting. And they're saying this is a biblical principle, and you think, okay, now which biblical principles are those again? You know, not providing. Okay. So, but no texts are cited. Anyway, let me just read another one. Okay, this is a good one too, the combination. Okay, civil government exists to secure the blessings of liberty. The most basic of these creator-endowed blessings were defined in the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, which mentions life, liberty, and private property. Scripture defines God as the source of life in Genesis. God is the author of liberty as well. And then it quotes Leviticus 25:10, the Jubilee passage, which is really interesting, but it quotes the King James translation, which does have liberty. So scripture is the author of liberty as well. Proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. Scripture also defines God as the source of private property and the pursuit of happiness as expressed in the Declaration of Independence. Ecclesiastes 5:19 states, "For every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to rejoice in his labor. This is a gift of God." Also in 1 Chronicles 29:12 and 1 Timothy. Okay. So it's this kind of thinking, sort of a hodgepodge of piece together, Statue of Liberty, Constitution, Leviticus 25, Fifth Amendment, Ecclesiastes. I mean, it's a Bible verse here, a Bible verse there, and then, of course, for the key one, so it had a Bible verse for blessing, it had a Bible verse for liberty, even though it's really funny to use the Jubilee verse for liberty, because that's, you know, the exact opposite, and then says, scripture also provides for private property, but then there's no Bible verse for that. All right, but this is, I should say, what's being promoted now as a kind of, in some circles, and again, it's very right-wing fundamentalist circles. And like I said, I think it's very telling now that some Republicans like John Danforth, Christopher Shays, and others are also speaking out against the extreme Christian right in the political scene right now. So there's obviously division within the Republican Party and certainly among Democrats. I mean, the landscape of all this fits in the U.S. is broad.
Barbara, just a question. They started off saying something about as provided for in the law and the Gospels. What do they mean by the law? Do they mean the Old Testament? Or
it could be the Pauline sense. Yeah, probably the Old Testament, but you know, it could be this law, Gospel, dichotomy. They don't really spell it out. It's a kind of a hodgepodge. And they might mean U.S. law. Who knows? Yeah, they don't spell it out. And then I even looked at the footnote, and they're quoting a guy named Wolf. But they don't have scripture verses for it. They just say, see this guy named Wolf. Okay. That's the dilemma, I guess. And coupled with that, let me say, there are other texts that they touch on that, I mean, I shouldn't be just setting this up as a foil, but I am in fact doing it because to me it's a very alarming foil. The book is also very clear that communal enterprise does not work. Now, those of you who know American history, this will be, you can know better than I do. But anyway, they're telling the story of America's history as America's providential history. So they acknowledge that there are Bible passages in Acts 2 and Acts 4 that I want to look at tomorrow that have koinonia or a sense of community, of holding goods in common. And they say that the pilgrims tried that and found it didn't work because the profit motive provides individuals with needed incentive in a Christian free economy based on individual enterprise. Communal farming with no individual incentive does not even work with Christians. The pilgrims tried this and they almost starved to death. To alleviate this problem, the leaders shifted to an individual enterprise system. And they say that in 1623, this was that the pilgrims made the switch. So anyway, it just goes to show, don't try anything communal according to this version because you're going to starve to death. And God has mandated private property. Okay. All right. I have been wondering where some of this comes from. And I did stumble upon And I'm so excited about this book that I just bought used. Fortunately, I didn't buy it new. But this is, as I said, there's a whole range now of evangelical environmentalists or anti-environmentalists as well. But this one is a guy named Calvin Beiser. This book was funded by the Acton Institute, a very conservative right-wing think tank. And basically, even though this is couched as an environmental book, it's essentially an attack on environmentalism from an Acton-funded Christian scholar, who argues, it's so faint, the pen was running out, we need Jubilee for these magic markers, who argues, yes, indeed, the Bible says the land belongs to God. I mean, that's the land ethic in the Bible, fundamentally. And so if you take a look, for example, at Psalm 24:1, I mean, there's a danger of just taking a Bible verse here, a Bible verse there, but I would say this is the largely dominant land ownership ethic in the Bible, is that nobody owns the land absolutely except for God. Psalm 24:1. Who wants to read this for us? This can be our Bible verse for today.
The earth is the Lord's and all that is in it, the world and all and those who live in it.
All right. And then it goes on to talk about because God created. Okay, so the earth is the Lord's. And the Bible variously describes us as tenants, and certainly as having a responsibility to live on the land, to care for it, to use it. But God is the owner of the land. But Beiser argues, okay, environmentalists love to cite that verse, you know. But that needs to be tempered in his view. So I'll just give the other side here with Psalm 115, verse 16. That's that next one down there. Psalm 115, verse 16. Who would like to read this one?
The heavens belong to the Lord, but he has given the earth to all mankind.
Aha. Okay, so, and indeed, I mean, I think in a sense he is correct that these two Bible verses have to be held in tension in some way. There's a sense that God owns all the land, but God has put human beings on the earth. But the question is then, how do you use a verse like this one? To what extent does this mean, you know, God has sort of absconded up to the heavens and given the earth to us to do whatever we want with it? Or to what extent is it, a relative ownership even here? And we have to talk about that one. But this Beiser and others who are really into, let's just say, the property rights movement now, the takings, vigilant people who would argue that any time the common good limits anybody's right to do anything, you have to compensate. I mean, that whole range now in American life is very lively. And he would point to a verse like this to say, no, God does in fact give ownership to humans. But as we begin to look at the Jubilee passage, I mean, the whole way that the Jubilee passage is structured in Leviticus 25, which is going to be ultimately our text for today, although I'm going to look at a couple other ones too, but this is near the beginning of the Bible. Actually, if somebody finds it, tell us the page number, okay? Many people who have these maroon Bibles will have the same page number, so.
107 in the Revised Standard.
Okay. Oh, all right, we have a lot of different pages then. Okay. Well, everybody, just share your page numbers. Yeah. Okay. But here, too, in Leviticus 25, whoops, it's especially verse 23. I put up the wrong verse number here. Would somebody read Leviticus 25:23?
The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. With me you are but aliens and tenants.
Okay, so this then becomes the basis for this whole Jubilee idea of redistribution. You can redistribute the land because it all belongs to God. And each person is given an inheritance, a tenancy that actually is inviolable in the Bible. That's the other idea. And that would not work in today's capitalist society, because people want to be able to buy and sell land. And in the Old Testament, there is a sense that once you were given this ancestral heritage, it belongs to your family forever and ever, and you cannot, in fact, sell it. In fact, the whole story, another very important biblical passage in 1 Kings 21, the whole story of Naboth's vineyard, which is another one that environmentalists love to cite. I mean, let's just say we're getting some of these out there that Visor and others would say, yes, yes, you know, they're constantly harping on this one. They love to cite Isaiah 5, don't build house to house. But in Naboth's vineyard, why don't we take a look at that one? Because what's so interesting here is King Ahab, wicked King Ahab, First Kings 21. I don't know how much we can read it. Let me see what I'm planning here. Well, we could look at this one. We've got time. I only have about 15 more Bible passages. But this is an interesting one because think about, okay, what's the idea of land ownership here? Let's just read till verse 7. We'll get through wicked Jezebel and how she's the power behind Ahab. Poor King Ahab. You know, he wouldn't have been bad except that his wife influenced him. Somebody want to read this one?
Later, the following events took place. Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard in Jezreel beside the palace of King Ahab of Samaria. And Ahab said to Naboth, give me your vineyard so that I may have it for a vegetable garden, because it is near my house. I will give you a better vineyard for it, or if it seems good to you, I will give you its value in money. But Naboth said to Ahab, the Lord forbid that I should give you my ancestral inheritance. Ahab went home resentful and sullen because of what Naboth the Jezreelite had said to him. For he had said, I will not give you my ancestral inheritance. He lay down in his bed, turned away his face, and would not eat. His wife Jezebel came to him and said, why are you so depressed that you will not eat? He said to her, because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite and said to him, give me your vineyard for money, or else, if you prefer, I will give you another vineyard for it. But he answered, I will not give you my vineyard. His wife Jezebel said to him, do you not govern Israel? Get up, eat some food, and be cheerful. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth of Jezreelite.
Okay, so she does. She has him killed. You know, it's a very elaborate situation here. And then the prophet Elijah has to intervene after the fact and say, you know, Jezebel's going to be eaten by dogs. But anyway, notice here, King Ahab is willing to compensate. It's not that he's planning to take the vineyard. He's willing to pay for it or trade for it, whatever Naboth wants. But Naboth just says, I can't sell or trade this land. This is my family's nahalah, is the Hebrew word, and And it's impossible. And then there, it's the interesting thing, they don't use the word sell here, it's give. But it's just this idea that I don't, you know, have the right to sell this land. I can't. And so King Ahab knows that law too, and he just goes and lies on his bed against the wall because he's, you know, pouting, but he knows he can't do anything. But wicked Jezebel, the foreign queen, comes in and has a different land ethic. and is able to engineer this this power grab here. So that idea of the land as your nahala, your ancestral inheritance that is your family's forever and ever, I think is very strongly throughout the Bible. Now, we should bracket, though, of course, the anguish even of that, which is that these lands are given out in Joshua to the various tribes and stuff and families after the conquest. But we need to remember there were people on the land before that, too. And that's the dilemma also in American history as well. I mean, the land was not empty in Canaan. People were dispossessed from the land. And those are some of the same kinds of issues going on now in Israel and Palestine as well, that who has a claim to the land and how do ancestral claims work? Can people, Israelis, for example, Jews, who certainly have a very ancient biblical claim to the land, can they come in and lay claim to land that has been held by another people for 2,000 years? And let me just segue now into Jubilee, because that's one of the interesting theories on Jubilee too. To what extent can someone who's been gone for generations and generations come back and reclaim something or not? And then especially with Middle East, how do we balance Palestinian claims? But you know, I'm not going to get into those issues so much, but I think it's a very important question for today. If you can draw direct line straight out of the Old Testament into the modern state of Israel, I would say no. I think one has to be very careful about those kinds of claims, but that, of course, is something Christians are really debating. Okay, well, let's get into the Jubilee, because I just want to present a couple different theories on this. In Leviticus 25, if you've never read this chapter, I would invite you today to read it. It's really beautiful. All right, now I can find Leviticus here. What page was it on?
104?
115. Okay.
I'm kind of biased since I've been a real estate broker for 36 years. But in chapter 25.
Of Leviticus?
Yes.
Okay.
It refers to selling or sold, I think approximately 20 times. Were they breaking God's law when they were doing this then? Or were they following God's?
Well, this is, well, we'll look at it, because what it is you can apparently, according to this chapter, and let me just say, this Leviticus is priestly material. So we think in the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, there are different strands of authorship too. There's the priestly writer, there's the Deuteronomist, there's the Yahwist, probably the oldest, there's the eldest. So this is priestly stuff. Here, apparently, as we look at it, you can sell it for a time. But as of 50 years, every 50 years, those sales are null and void, which is interesting. So theoretically, what it was if you're, say, in the 36th year, you would only sell it for, I can't do my math, for 14/36th of what it was worth, knowing that whoever you sold it to would just get to use it for 14 years. If this was really applied, I mean, but scholars really debate whether this Jubilee law was in fact ever applied or whether it was just kind of a utopian vision, because it seems rather impractical. But it does have this notion of selling, but that it's only a kind of temporary sale. But let's read some of this, because that's very interesting. And of course, I mean, then it would be, even though the word sell is the English one, it probably would be more like what we understand in English as leasing, you know, that you would sell somebody a lease for 99 years or 14 years or whatever. So it doesn't, it's not what we would define as sale in the sense that it's not absolute in this chapter. But that's a really important question. Obviously, this isn't going to work for real estate law, okay? You know, it's, I think we can all acknowledge that. But the question is, I mean, I'm sure as a real estate broker, you've sold properties that have had easements on them. I mean, for example,
yeah.
I once looked at a lot that had a power line easement on it. So there, so we know how now to sell things with restrictions, or if something has already gone into a land conservancy or something, then you can sell the land, but not with ever rights
it's
to build it.
It's a bundle of sticks theory. You have a bundle of sticks,
yeah.
And some of these sticks are taken away by various laws or various rights of other people. So what you're buying is the leftover bundle of sticks
uh-huh.
when you buy property.
Uh-huh. And even if the property line or the power line hasn't gone on yet, if you have an easement, the power company theoretically could, or if you've got a piece of property that has, say, oil drilling rights owned by somebody else. I mean, so we know how to do this. Well, anyway, okay, so there was this idea that even with people's or families' nahalas, with their inheritance, sometimes they'd fall into very hard times and have to sell their land. But it was only going to be temporary. So let's read about some of those verses. Let's read 25 to 28. And then we'll do 35 to 38. It's just a couple of examples here of how the principle works. Somebody want to read 25 to 28?
If any one of your kin falls into difficulty and sells a piece of property, then the next of kin shall come and redeem what the relative has sold. If the person has no one to redeem it, but then prospers and finds sufficient means to do so, the years since its sale shall be computed, and the difference shall be refunded to the person to whom it was sold, and the property shall be returned. But if there is not sufficient means to recover it, what was sold shall remain with the purchaser until the year of Jubilee. In the Jubilee it shall be released, and the property shall be returned.
Okay, so that's the hard times contingency. Now let's look at the slave. Is this the slavery one? Oh, no, this is, okay, dependent on you. Okay, and then we'll do slavery after that. Okay, would somebody read 35 to 38?
If
any of your kin fall into difficulty and become dependent on you, you shall support them. They shall live with you as though resident aliens. Do not take interest in advance or otherwise make a profit from them that fear your God. You shall not lend them your money at interest taken in advance or provide them food at a profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan to be your God.
So interesting how economic principles are woven in with I am the Lord your God and stuff. Uh-huh.
We've got an example right here that this property does not belong to Holden. It belongs to the U.S. Government Forest Service. And we have it for 14 years, as I understand it. And then we either renew a lease or move up.
Uh-huh. But it's interesting that we do own the property on the other side of the creek where the mining claim is, because America's mining claim laws are, let me say goofy. Anyone can go in and lay claim to anything basically for free if you can find ore on it. These are the old 19th century mining laws. So that's the oddity. And up at Spider Gap where you're hiking, there's a claim up there that somebody owns. It used to be an old mine. I mean, so people can own pieces of property in the wilderness area, in the forest, national forest, because mining claims trump everything. But yeah, that's a very good example.
It doesn't do us any good. We can't all of a sudden move these buildings up onto the mountain. So we renegotiate every 20 years for a new lease.
Yeah, and that's a good example. I mean, I think ultimately what we have to come to, I was just reading this article in Orion magazine that's in the library here. Yes, I took it out of the library, but I only brought it in here, and I'll get a free because if you've seen the signs in the library, you know that, you know, there's sin and then there's sin and removing man. But anyway, I was looking at this article in here by a guy named Eric Freifogel, This Land Is My Land, Private Property and the American Way. And his thesis in here is that that we have a strong notion of private property in America, but that we've always been willing to sort of redefine and shift. I mean, we have to have different understandings as circumstances change. Here, and he argues, this is his thesis, hardly any institution is more in need of critical thought than private ownership. It is, in truth, a more flexible, value-laden communal institution than people realize. Over the generations, the rights of landowners have been redefined again and again in an evolutionary shift that still goes on. I think most of us would agree with that, although perhaps disagree with the directions he goes. I mean, things like... another one Jane works on in Indiana, I think I can say this, is the whole issue of these huge hog farms now, you know, that are basically, I forget what they're called, but
factory farms,
well, that would be a value-laden term there, but aren't they called like
large
hog confinement?
Large confined animal facilities.
Yes. You know, and so we all have these idyllic pictures. I mean, you've read Little House in the Big Woods, you know, Little House. You know, there's always been the rights in America to have a couple of pigs, you know, when Laura and her family slaughter the pig, you know, and go squealing. You don't want to limit somebody's right on that. But but the question is, and even, you know, 100 or 200 pigs, but when it's thousands and the neighbors talk about this stench that is making them ill and those kinds of issues, and then these huge... manure confinement things that if they ever leak, it's absolutely catastrophic for water supplies. Do we want it? Has this then become industry rather than a farm? And how do you decide? So those issues, you know, are facing Iowa now very much. I don't know what the laws are. Minnesota, maybe a little less so, but many of you are from the Midwest know these kinds of issues.
They're outlawed in Minnesota.
They are outlawed in Minnesota. That's what I thought. Okay, but... certainly not in Iowa or Indiana, at least not recently. So we all face in our own communities various issues of properties. Let me just throw in one more. Oh, okay, about the Jubilee, though, let me say. Now, I've been reading this article that I have my students read. That the World Council of Churches a few years ago, as we were going into the millennium, the year 2000, there was a lot of talk about, should we observe this as a kind of jubilee? You know, these only happen every 1,000 years, so it's not like we're going to have to set a precedent for 50 years, you know, because nobody wants to do 50 years. But, you know, is there a way in which as we turn the millennium, or I mean a millennium or the century, 100 years, that we want to try to do in our global economy some kind of jubilee acts of forgiving debt. And in fact, debtor nations, you know, everybody knows they're not going to be able to pay their interest. It's just crippling. So should we forgive debt like this jubilee principle? So the World Council of Churches called together a consultation of biblical scholars to work on the jubilee themes. And a number of Old Testament scholars worked on it. But I just want to share with you from Norman Gottwald's article here, because this will be a little bit of cautionary about using, about thinking we can use any biblical passage, even Leviticus 25, beautiful as it sounds, and just import it into our century and think this is going to help us. He says, his article is entitled, "The Biblical Jubilee, in Whose Interests?" And he basically proposes, yes, you know, principles of land redistribution are very important because, you know, these texts are written in a time of farmers being squeezed by imperial society. But yet, he argues that because it's a priestly text, the texts in Leviticus are priestly, he thinks there's a possibility that the extension of the seven-year sabbatical principle, oh, that's in Exodus, that you have every 7 years you leave the land fallow, which is interesting. But that sabbatical notion is being extended now to all to land ownership and put as every seven times seven, that is every 49th in the 50th year. The fact that this is being extended by the priestly party vying for leadership in restored Judah, because he's saying, look, you know, we know these are older texts, but they're written as the people were coming out of exile. I mean, I hope this isn't a shock to you. The texts weren't written when they say they were, we don't think. After the exile in Babylon, as the Persians were letting the exiles go back, and remember that we can see in Jeremiah and other places that the only ones who actually went into exile in Babylon were the elites, the kings, the rulers, the elites. They actually had to go to Babylon in exile, but left on the land were the poor farmers. So Gottwald's thesis is these poor farmers, meanwhile, went to farm all the land, and he thinks that basically the Jubilee Law maybe was a priestly land grab, an elite land grab to get back their land. It would have been attractive for returning exiles whose land had fallen into other hands in their absence to have this biblical notion of returning the land to its original owners. The Jubilee program could be viewed, and he's only hypothesizing as this one view, as the political and economic ploy of the Aaronite priests to achieve leadership in a restored Judah by dispensing benefits to a wide swath of the populace, presumably with civil and military support from the Persians. Ooh. So then you think, oh my gosh, even the Jubilee, you know, is that another land grab? But I think it shows the complexity of these kinds of land issues that we face in places like East Germany. You know, did the people who had been dispossessed from their homes 20, 30 years earlier get to go back and claim them? Yes, in fact, Germany let people do that. And certainly the question with Jews' homes all through Europe that had been taken during Nazi Germany, what rights do people have to reclaim their property? Yes, they certainly do. Now, it's interesting, Palestinians assert some of those same rights that for homes that were taken after 1948. Shouldn't we be able to go back and reclaim our homes? You know, so it's always an issue of, and you know, if the exile lasted 70 years, does somebody after 70 years get to go back and displace a farmer that has been farming that land those 70 years? Those kinds of questions are very complex ones as we seek to apply biblical principles in a just way. Now, certainly, I just want to end with this and open up for discussion. Jesus invoked Jubilee traditions in announcing the kingdom of God. I mean, that's clear. So there's this sense of the land belonging to God and every poor person having some rights to the land. Oh, we haven't even looked at the law of gleanings. Did I put that one up there? This would be Leviticus 23, a really important one, I think, for us to think about as well, that even if you own the land, you can't just do whatever you want with it. You're not allowed to reap to the margins, for example. You've got to allow, this. Look at Leviticus 23, 22. Somebody want to read this one?
When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and for the alien. I am the Lord your God.
And this, of course, becomes very important in the book of Ruth, you know, where they have lost their land, but they can still come back and glean. I mean, so this is this would be an interesting one to try to apply today. And I should just say, I was so pleased with, I teach a class, I co-teach with an Old Testament scholar, Ted Hebert, on the biblical views of nature, views, multiple views. But we did this as towards the end of our course, I think in the 11th week, a kind of case study, asking students, okay, you know, let's say you're hypothetically a pastor or a church leader who's been asked to meet with some landowners and environmentalists in your church about what does the Bible say about land ownership and what landowners can do. You know, what biblical text would you look at? Because that's always the question on any issue, homosexuality, whatever. It's all, what texts are you going to invoke as analogies? Because that's all we can do as analogies to our contemporary situation. I was really pleased when some of my students came up with this one. And then they also looked at Paul, very interesting, 1 Corinthians 9, where Paul says, although I have rights as an apostle to get wages, to have a wife, I'm not going to exercise all my rights. So this notion that a person might have rights, might have land ownership, you don't exercise the rights absolutely, but you temper them for the sake of the neighbor. And they use texts like that to try to help both the environmentalists and landowners in this hypothetical situation come to some common ground about seeing commonality and how we don't have to exercise absolute rights that harm our neighbors. So it's a very interesting dilemma, and I'm sure you're facing it in ways that are fascinating in your own community. So, I was just going to say, but Jubilee, even if it was utopian, and nobody else, I don't think, agrees with Gottwald, so I just want to throw out his hypothesis, a very provocative one. The principle, nonetheless, of Jubilee, even if it was never exercised of actually doing it, it continues as a principle throughout the Bible that is lifted up at various points. And Jesus, when he comes into, in Luke 4, we can just look at that passage, and he's quoting here Isaiah 65. Sorry, I can't even find Luke 4. No, this is my own field. Okay. Let's read Luke 4, 14 to 19. Or 16. Let's do 16 and 19.
When he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor."
Okay, and he's quoting here Isaiah 61, where the year of the Lord's favor, proclaiming liberty, that passage that the America's Providential History wants to cite, is the Hebrew word deror. So, I mean, even though Luke is written in Greek, we know that he's quoting this passage, and that's hearkening back to the Jubilee year idea. So the acceptable year would be the Jubilee year. A couple of good books on that and Jesus program, John Howard Yoder's book. We have this in the Holden Library, I'm sure, The Politics of Jesus. This one, unfortunately, we don't. I need to try to find a copy. It's out of print, and donate this to Holden because I think it could help us every year in Jubilee. This is by a New Testament scholar, Sharon Ringey, Jesus, Liberation, and the Biblical Jubilee, Images for Ethics and Christology, talking about how Jesus is invoking some of these ancient Jubilee traditions in announcing the reign of God as dawning in their midst. Now, obviously, he had no authority to just go out and proclaim a Jubilee and get land ownership back, but he's tapping into this vision and reminding people there is this tradition that we have of Jubilee, of the year of the Lord. And what does that mean then if we realize that that reign of God is dawning in our midst? In the midst of all the imperial oppression, economic inequalities, the Roman Empire, what does it mean to announce Jubilee and to enact that in our daily life as local villages now trying to live as God's faithful people? That's what Jesus is doing. Okay, questions, comments? I guess that in some ways gets us back full circle to what I asked you at the beginning. about the empire and these notions of environment and empire. Oh, sorry, I just wanted to ask one last thing, though, sorry, about the Jubilee. What's not touched on in the Bible, though, as much, although it's hinted at in passages, because we certainly saw in Leviticus 25 that the poor have rights to reclaim their Nahalah, but there's still the question of do animals have rights? And that's one of the big questions with us right now with property rights, especially things like water rights. I was looking in the library for the revised edition of Bob Stivers' book on a case study book on ethics, because Bob Stivers and Jim Martin Schramm, who teach up here every other January, that teach a J term, a January term interim, use that case study book that they've written together of environmental case studies, and one of them is about water rights questions. That, you know, as water, like this is going to be a really dry summer, it already is, so the water flows in the rivers are very low. How do we then adjudicate when we've over-assigned rights? I mean, irrigation rights are based on good years of water. When we don't even have enough water to fulfill all the people's rights to irrigation that they own in perpetuity, do the salmon have any rights? Do we want to leave water for the animals as well? And how do we adjudicate them? Do they have legitimate claims on land and scarce resources? I think these are issues that we have to really face as well in a lot of these questions. And then how do we speak on behalf of the sparrow or the snail dart or the spotted owl? Do we want to do that, in fact, and expand the Jubilee principle to include Jubilee for all of nature, not just for the poor in our midst? Because I now am convinced by Leonardo Boff, a liberation theologian, who says we can't just listen to the cry of the poor, we also have to listen to the cry of the earth. Both cries are crying out to us, and how do we balance these? Okay, now again, I talked
the whole
thing. I have a
question. Are you suggesting that this theology that you're speaking of somehow be the way life should be in the future for Christians or people that are endeavoring to live this holy life before God? Are you suggesting that, or are you just using this as historical, what has gone on?
Well, no, I guess I would suggest that we should live in terms of the Bible. But what does that mean?
I'm going to tell you right now that what you're saying there is so far from American law the way it is today. It's not going to happen. It doesn't work that way.
Okay, so the question would be, as Christians then, is there any sense in which we do want to try to live in terms of some of it? That we want to live out the biblical teachings in some way in our environmental and land stewardship, and how would we do that?
I would say yes, but to apply being a kind of somewhat of a biblical scholar myself, not necessarily studying in depth land, but studying American law from as a Christian nation, I find that the way land is handled now is in some ways, I'm not talking about the people that would perpetrate evils or do wrong things or so on and so forth, but the way it's done now is quite reasonable.
Okay, well, others? I think you're right. And the capitalist system obviously is different.
I'm not talking about capitalist system.
Well, that would be our law.
I'm talking about land law. Yeah.
And that's capitalism. Yeah. It's based on capitalist. It's John Locke and the principles of economics, I think. I mean, I'm out of my field.
It is, yeah.
This is why I want you all to speak up, because I'm really out of my field.
I wouldn't say that.
You would not say American law is capitalist. Okay, others?
I would disagree with the previous speaker and agree with you. And I think the law in the United States is sufficiently unclear that it exists, and the law itself is clear, but the decisions are unclear. And one good example is in the Klamath Basin of Oregon, which is a very dry area, but it's all irrigated and farmed. And they get the water out of the river, the Klamath River, which is also full of fish. And there has been this problem now for many years, since Clinton's administration, of when there is not enough water in the river, should they allow the farmers to use it for irrigation and let the fish die? and not have enough water below the river, I guess, for people to drink as well? Or should they not do that? And that has been a problem now with our government and the laws for, I don't know, 5, 6, 10 years. And it seems to be a problem that is becoming more and more acute because there gets to be drier and drier seasons. And it's beginning to appear that the Klamath Basin should probably never have been planted. Uh-huh. It's getting so dry every year that I don't know what's happening now, but I think the law is what decides how much water is going to be given to the farmers and how much water is going to be left in the river. And the law does exist for that. And the president makes that decision in part.
Let me clarify that. I wasn't talking about the caring of the land, which what you're talking about and what you ended with is, in my mind, it's making laws to care for the land, to care for all the resources, to care for everything to properly steward your land. But what I was talking about is the distribution between people.
Okay.
So we're on two different stuff.
All right, thanks. It is great to hear about your local situations. I should just say, I think what has helped us in the Pacific Northwest, at least this is my limited knowledge, has been the glaciers. The fact that we have had a more steady source of water than, say, in Colorado. I mean, that's where you really see water rights battles. I mean, and so they are going with more ancestral rights. Water is taken wholesale from the west side over to the east side. I mean, there's a ethicist at Colorado State University in Fort Collins named Holmes Rolston, who works a lot on this issue, very interestingly. But he just says the whole system of water rights in the west is not going to be able to continue to work as the glaciers melt, and we will not have the kinds of water flows that we've based the whole thing on. I mean, it's really interesting. Others? Uh-huh.
It seems to be, such as the Klamath Basin, that it's a political decision until it gets to the Supreme Court, because the Secretary of Agriculture makes the decision. And, for instance, in Colorado, Los Angeles bought the water rights. They have the rights, I don't know for how long.
I know, in Northern California the same way, yeah. Los Angeles is the bad guy.
I think many of us say the same bad guy.
Yeah. Okay, and just to say, it is certainly political, but we're the polis. I mean, certainly we can grant that we have to, as a polis, deliberate together about how we want to see these things adjudicated. So thanks. Others, about your situation, how you see the Bible relating, if at all, to the property rights issues that you've experienced or that are lively in your community? Uh-huh.
Well, I just think about the recent G8 summit and the notion that, you know, our government, as part of, you know, community of nations, should be forgiving debts in Africa. And there were 18 countries whose debts were forgiven, but that wasn't the totality of the debt that could have been forgiven. And, you know, should we, as Christians, be pushing our representatives and our president to be, you know, to enact that principle more, especially since he says that he is following Christian principles? I mean, we might, you know, have a stronger claim with him if we speak out and say that these principles should be followed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, have some of you followed that? I don't see anybody with one of those one bracelets on. Pardon me?
It falls off my wrist.
It falls off, but you know what it is. Yeah. You've had one? Okay, anybody else, have you had one? It was the beginning of July, right? There was a huge movement worldwide to get the G8 to work on debt forgiveness. Now, I forgot why we were wearing these one bracelets, though. What did that have to do?
It was One Voice United for 1%.
1%, that's it. 1% of what?
Of the GNP.
Of the GNP, okay. Yeah. And Bono, I mean, all these rock musicians got involved with it, right? And it's these white vinyl bracelets that you can get from Bread for the World or all kinds of others. I mean, it's quite a campaign going on right now. Very interesting to enact in some way, 1%, this biblical jubilee principle. Uh-huh. Somebody had a hand. Oh, a bunch of hands over here. Okay, go ahead.
Here's something that shook me up this summer, kind of like the Gottwald idea. It's just shaking me today. This is more of an urban issue. There was a Supreme Court decision just recently. This is an urban issue.
In Connecticut,
domain.
Right?
I think it's New London, Connecticut.
Yes.
Where the city has basically been allowed to take people's homes to build a convention center and some other stuff.
So that they can raise property tax revenue, yeah.
And, you know, always, my knee-jerk reaction is always to be on the side of, you know, the community's right to override private property rights for the common good. And now it's real clear that can be used for great evil. So, darn, it's confusing.
Yeah, and the constellation of groups on that one. Yeah, darn, it's confusing. Okay, thanks for that one. Uh-huh.
Well, you want a local example. We live in Kentucky, and coal mining's big, and the way they do it now is doing it off the surface. So coal companies have rights to coal in these mountains. So they shear off the tops of the mountains to get at the coal, and then dump what they sheared off into the streams. And so people downstream are getting their waters cut off, or they're getting all kinds of sludge and gook, and people live on the other side of the mountain, the boulders are falling on their houses, and it's just a horrible mess, but they have the right to get into that coal, which is preserved and upheld.
Yeah, mining rights are amazing. I should say, at the beginning of Jared Diamond's book, I told you the first day I was reading Jared Diamond's book, Collapse, he talks about Montana as a kind of case study and basically says that if you try to weigh the economic consequences of what's happened, like with that huge mine in Butte, I don't know how many of you drove past that coming out here, and what it's done to the Clark Fork River. I mean, the cleanup costs of these things are going to be so much more than what was ever taken out of the mines, that from a, you know, true cost-benefit standpoint, at least in his view, it's going to be more expensive now than it would have been to just leave it there. But you're right, the companies have the rights to do whatever they want.
I think
they have lobbyists.
Yeah.
Another part of that is that there are people living on the mountain,
right.
And they own their home, but they don't own the mineral rights to that mountain. So the company can come in and shear off the mountain, and their house goes with it, and that's legal. And
well,
now they
I don't
have
know
no
how
place.
You find that legal.
They have no place to go
because
they've got there.
Because the law that you don't know.
Well, what Jared Diamond points out, I mean, is that he argues, though, that in Montana, and I would probably in Kentucky, the dilemma is that these were some of the best wage jobs in the late 1900s and early 20th century. And this is what made these communities viable economically. They had you know, health insurance and pension programs. And, I mean, they were the best employers, but now we see the consequence of this, certainly in terms of people's health as well. Others, what's going on in your local area?
I live near New London, Connecticut.
Aha!
And the issue there was that the city of New London, which has been depressed for a long time, is trying to rejuvenate, is taking a private house and private property for private development, okay? Not public development. The general law of eminent domain says that the institutional, governmental institution can take property for public use. But in this case, they ruled the opposite and said that the city of New London could take that house, which is one of the only ones left in that whole area, for private development. See, that's the key
uh-huh.
question.
And then
that goes the opposite
yeah.
of what the general laws.
But my understanding is there were environmentalist groups on both sides on that one, right? And it was a funny constellation of left-wing and right-wing people. I mean, it's complex. It sounds like, I don't know what you think on it, but this is one of the many right now. It was a 5-4 Supreme Court ruling, right? So this is, there's somebody,
I could say a lot about real estate since I've been my experience, but I was questioning the way we're studying this. It seems like we've been presumed or assumed that we should follow the law in Deuteronomy and Leviticus as written at that time for those people, that we're assuming that that should apply to us now in this day. We didn't get to the last part of chapter 25 where God gives me the right to own slaves as long as I turn them loose ever so many years. I hope we don't apply that to our living today. And I think some of these other things we were not to apply 100% like written in the Bible in our society today. I think it would be very cruel and
right, and that's the dilemma. Let me just say, as we're going to have to end here, but that's certainly the challenge for us as Christians. I mean, obviously, none of us probably applies Leviticus 25:37. You shall not lend money at interest. I don't know about you, but I've got CDs in the bank earning interest. I'm violating this biblical law. So we are. But on the other hand, in what sense then should Scripture guide us nonetheless in some of our economic and land ownership decision? I think you probably wouldn't argue you want to throw out the Bible.
Well, no.
So how do we decide what to throw it out on? I mean, so that's the issue on things like homosexuality and so much else. I mean, we want to use the Bible as our norm and our guide, but how do we take something written for an ancient time that was not capitalist? I mean, obviously, to infer capitalism to flourish, you have to lend money at interest. That was the basic thing that happened in the shift after the Reformation, moving into the rise of the Enlightenment. I wish I were a better historian here, but we had to overcome this one. But to what extent does this biblical vision still call to us in some ways? I mean, do we want to have a sense of this gleanings, you know, and what would that be in modern day society, that you don't get to reap everything off your land? You know, are there ways in which we want to continue to try to live as biblical people, even though our economy and environmental situation is very, very different? And how do we decide together what that looks like as communities? All right, you can have the last word.
Okay. I think this whole idea of Jubilee is showing that we should treat people decent, honestly, help them when we can, try to do as Christ would do, or as Christ has instructed us to do.
Okay, let me just ask, I will have the last word then. Is it just people? And that's one of the big questions challenging us right now. Is it just people? Because that's in Leviticus. Or do we want to extend it to nature as well, to glaciers? Yes. And that's a dilemma. Okay.
One more thing. Just to remind you, there's a forum this afternoon on what kinds of practices and policies Christians ought to prefer when it comes to the economy.
Yeah, so bring all these comments.
So
this is really important.
All these concerns back to the forum at 5 this afternoon.
Yes, the conversation continues.
Here in the